The Airline Business Podcast is sponsored by Panasonic Avionics. Hello and welcome to the Airline Business Podcast, discussing key news and trends in the global airline sector. This time, all change at Boeing, but will it be enough to keep airlines on side? And are European carriers progressing in making their case in Brussels? My name's Graham Dunn, Executive Editor at Flight Global, and joining me as ever is Airline Business Editor Lewis Harper. Hi, Lewis.
Hi, Graham. How are you?
Yes, very good, very good. Spring is in the air in many ways.
I don't know how I'm going to connect that to what we're talking about, but yes, it is.
Totally.
Yes,
it feels like
very literal. I'll just be very literal. Okay.
It does feel as though there should be a link, but I don't think there is.
Certainly not so, Boeing. There you go.
There you go.
Well, no, yes, maybe it is. Sorry, no, to be fair, maybe it is.
Is there or isn't there a spring in the step at Boeing? Well, we talked about this at the start of the year, how, you know, very quickly the kind of the mood and the agenda for the year change amid the challenges at Boeing from the start in January. And that has just continued and become, I guess, something of a soap opera on the one hand. And Boeing have taken steps to try and draw a line under things. So the news has just come out of the management change at Boeing. So right at the top, Chief Executive Dave Calhoun will step down at the end of the year. Stan Deal, who heads the commercial aircraft unit, he will step down. He retires immediately. He's replaced by Stephanie Pope. And the chairman is also departing. So the chairman, Larry Kellner, is to go, and he's being replaced by Steve Mollenkopf. And these changes, I guess, on the one hand, I mean, arguably, maybe it become a bit inevitable, but I suppose it's come amid, you know, mounting challenges for Boeing. And also, we've also probably seen, and I mentioned about keeping airlines on side during this crisis. And I think actually, for a lot of the challenges that Boeing have had during this period, I think the airline customers have largely had a relatively supportive approach. But there were definitely signs, I suppose, in the last month or so that maybe airline frustrations were beginning to tell.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I think it's really notable as well that's come from a couple of US carriers who are obviously massive Boeing customers. And also we've seen some comments from Ryanair in Europe, I think the biggest MAX customers here. They're always treading a delicate balancing act, the airlines, because on the one hand, they're all very keen to stress that they, in terms of the actual aircraft, so the MAXs in this case, that they like the aircraft, they think they're safe and they want them in most cases. But, you know, there's so much going on. And I think the situation, as you touched on there, is kind of, you know, they really were thrown onto the back foot going into this year with the Alaska Airlines door plug blowout. That I think there's just been a growing sense, you know, amid those comments from customers, you know, and alongside that, obviously, the step up in regulatory scrutiny. There's sort of almost a sense that, you know, how many fresh starts can you have? But ultimately, it probably, you know, reaching the point where, you know, the noises were loud enough that it felt like, you know, a new leadership might be necessary. Now, you could argue, you know, the problems today, the current leadership are working on them. We know, you know, quality issues of stuff coming out of the factory is one big concern for a lot of airlines, alongside obviously the delays that are resulting from a partly a global issue for all kind of manufacturers at the moment around supply chain, but particularly now Boeing's got so much more scrutiny on it again. So yeah, you can see that really something's been building up. There's been Scott Kirby at United has been quite strong in, you know, unusually, I think we're used to certainly some of the European airline CEOs being quite outspoken when they're upset about, you know, something the manufacturers. It, you know, I was quite surprised at how strongly a couple of the US airline CEOs have come out in recent weeks, you know, calling for change at Boeing and talking about, you know, reconsidering orders, this kind of thing. So that, you know, Scott Kirby at United and Bob Jordan at Southwest being two that that stand out there. So yeah, there's kind of been just a growing sense. I think, you know, as I said, whether leadership change, you know, the sense was when Calhoun came in that was the fresh start that the LA needed. Notably, he was chair of the board, so perhaps there's a sense that, you know, may they look to an outsider now. But yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, it's difficult to cite one single factor here. This is something that's building up a long time, and I guess they're going to have another go at a fresh start in the leadership, and hope that you know, just gives them that momentum and the confidence within the customer base as well.
And I think it is worth saying, I think I had lost sight or lost track of how long actually the existing Boeing leadership have been there. I mean, Doug Calhoun came in, you know, it'll be 5 years in the role, which, you know, is a pretty regular kind of tenure. I mean, they've already been through a lot. I mean, obviously, you know, they came in the aftermath of the Boeing 737 MAX grounding. They kind of oversaw that element. They've obviously, having got that aircraft back up and running, having overcome all of that, which, you know, was a complicated process, involved a whole kind of re-engineering of the company culture in many ways. You then go through COVID, which creates a whole new level of it. And I think there does seem as though there's a kind of a, you know, the timing is quite a natural time to try and reset the company. You know, I think most people would commonly view that, you know, the larger challenge is on the shop floor rather than in the C-suite. You know, the problem has been, you know, and they're sort of widespread challenges that go well beyond Boeing, has been in recruiting people, in getting the workforce back up to speed across the board for the aerospace industry. And Boeing has this additional glare which makes it so much harder now for them to ramp up production. And you're seeing Boeing looking at, you know, all manner of things, whether that is, you know, what to do with Spirit Aerostructures. Again, it's, you know, there are no straightforward solutions to this, but it definitely feels as though they, you know, now appears like a good time to try and draw a line under it. And, you know, it is interesting, the challenge keeping airlines on side through all of this is the disruption it causes in terms of aircraft planning and deliveries. And you could see, you know, when Scott Kirby's talking about some of the frustrations at United, that's, you know, that's around certification of future aircraft, that's around delivery of the MAX 10, you know, a process which kind of impacts that later forward planning of fleets. But then you also have someone like Michael O'Leary at Ryanair, and they have, you know, gradually they're having to accept that they are going to get less aircraft this summer when they really want to be making the most of it. I think they were after something like 57 Boeing MAX aircraft in time for the summer peak, and they're having to accept 40. So you have this, you know, longer term and near term challenges which are facing airlines, and also those are the challenges facing Boeing.
Precisely, yeah, and you talk about the shop floor, and clearly, just as an example, obviously, I was at the A4E meeting recently, and Michael O'Leary was there talking about, and as you say, there's a couple of fronts where this issue exists, and obviously Ryanair is frustrated that it can't grow as quickly as it wanted to, and I think twice now has downgraded its expectations for MAX deliveries for this summer. He talked about, you know, the quality of the product being sent from the Boeing factory as well. You know, he's keen to stress these aren't safety critical issues, but you know, he mentioned spanners under floorboards, missing handles on seats, basically saying, you know, $100 million products they're buying from Boeing, and it simply wasn't good enough, you know, aside from the fact that they're not getting enough of them. You know, he's saying that Ryanair has got 30 engineers on the ground at the Boeing factories. They do a 48-hour check on every new aircraft, and essentially what they're finding, you know, has improved a bit, but still isn't good enough. And I think in the case of O'Leary at Ryanair, his comment was that he did have faith in Calhoun and the kind of overall Boeing leadership, but he was, without saying the name, certainly when I heard him speak anyway, he was saying the change was needed at Seattle in reference to the commercial airplanes bit of the business. And we know that obviously Stan Deal has, I think, retired with immediate effect there. Stephanie Pope's come in to replace him. We know that. You know, interesting talking about the fresh start and everything. She's a 30-year Boeing veteran. She's chief operating officer previously, so she's been CFO of the commercial airplanes unit. So again, you know, a big challenge there. I think that's where I think a lot of the focus will be. The whole industry, obviously, thinking in a wider context, is, as you say, it's difficult to talk about this in isolation. There are clearly challenges if you operate Airbus aircraft, particularly if you have Pratt & Whitney engines on your A320neos at the moment. So, yeah, I think it's important to stress that, you know, that these challenges aren't unique to Boeing, but they are, you know, there are many. And I think when the Alaska Airlines door blowout happened, I think the incident itself, incredibly serious, and obviously could have been much more serious on a later phase of the flight. But in terms of the impact was, because of the MAX 9 is a relatively small fleet globally compared to the MAX 8, it wasn't as huge as it could have been, and it was resolved relatively quickly. They're all back in the air now. But it was always the case, I think, that the biggest danger to Boeing and, you know, what this made regulators do, the FAA do, and, you know, the impact then that then had on delivery times and, you know, and production rates, you know, again, just knocking the confidence of customers again. So yes, another fresh start ahead, I guess. You know, Boeing, Airbus is duopoly. People don't have many options. But that said, that doesn't mean they just put up with anything. So yeah, we'll keep a close eye on it anyway.
And it makes for, you know, as we've discussed previously, it's a sort of mixed picture in terms of, you know, what this means for airlines, both delays at Boeing and Airbus, the extra maintenance work that's having to take place on those Pratt & Whitney GTF-powered narrow bodies as well. That just means that airlines are able to have less aircraft available this summer than they would have. They're having to be creative about how they deploy their fleets, where they get aircraft in. We're seeing, you know, the usual mix of you know, people hanging on to existing aircraft that were going to exit the fleet for longer. You are seeing an airline like Aegean Airlines, for example, is shifting some of its capacity out of charter operations. It's had an operation it was involved with in Romania, I think, called Anima Wings, which they are they've sold out of. And, you know, one of the drivers of that is so that they can redeploy two aircraft in the more profitable scheduled operation. You know, they want to ensure that operation is as strong as possible. So you're seeing decisions like that. And I think we've just had the fourth quarter reporting season here in Europe. And, you know, it was quite evident, you know, airline CEOs were still talking about keeping, you know, more flex in the system, keeping backup aircraft. This isn't just about delays to aircraft. This is, you know, maintenance challenges in terms of, you know, the maintenance checks are taking much longer to happen. Not all the capacity issues and the congestion issues that have been a problem since COVID, they've not all gone away yet, not amongst all suppliers. You have the return of some old school issues like strikes, which have come back to affect you know, Germany most recently. So airlines have lots of reasons to be keeping that capacity in check. The flip side, as we've often talked about, is that this does mean that prices and fares are likely to remain high, that, you know, demand will continue to outstrip the supply. And, you know, that has a positive effect on airlines, on the bottom line of airlines. And I think in those early days of coming back from the pandemic, the industry came back at such a pace, you know, that demand was so insatiable. You know, you couldn't see a point where the recovery back to sort of pre-pandemic levels would be slower. If anything, it would be faster. But, you know, I think, you know, people were looking at this year as the point where you would be back at that level, and in many markets it is. But you know, for many airlines and companies out there, especially those with, you know, a large reliance on routes to Asia, for example, or who are maybe more affected by some of these aircraft and supply issues than others, it's going to take longer before you see that full return back to where we were.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, as you say, the I think what airline leaders, you know, kind of pushes them to speak out is the uncertainty, really. Like you say, I think they don't mind too much that, you know, if you're an incumbent in a market at the moment, it's still, you know, with exceptions, I think we've talked a bit about US short haul, where it is one of those markets where they're already above 2019 capacity, and that is, in certainly in certain routes and things, is creating very strong competition that is creating a few challenges around staying profitable, certainly for some of the low-cost carriers in the US. But as a general rule, the, you know, in Europe this summer, for example, we're probably a couple of percentage points, maybe a bit more below pre-COVID levels capacity-wise still. You know, and broadly, that has a positive impact on the bottom line for a lot of airlines. I think when the CEOs, you know, you see them getting upset, it's when, you know, particularly, and going back to Ryanair again, you've already said, oh, we're not going to get as many aircraft as we thought. And then 2 weeks later, you're saying it again because the situation has worsened. You know, I'm sure they would have been given reassurances over the past few months and years that, you know, those figures they were being told in terms of deliveries, etc., were, you know, looking good and on track. And you know, with everything that's happened at the start of the year, it's obviously Boeing has forced some changes there. But yes, it's I think, as I say, it's the uncertainty that they can't deal with, you know, having already made concessions, I think, to this situation. But broadly, as you say, in a lot of markets, I think the story is about lack of capacity, but still fairly broad expectations that that's going to keep fares high and is going to allow a lot of airlines to absorb what is also a high cost environment. And as you touched on labour, and that's certainly something we're keeping a close eye on, because we know there have been some pretty eye-watering settlements in the US in terms of, you know, pilot pay, etc. And I think you start to see some of that happening in Europe. You know, again, Ryanair has talked about some higher costs this year through settlements. So yeah, there's a lot going on. But I think, you know, the Boeing issues and what's happening with the Airbus aircraft is to an extent pushing back the rendezvous with reality in economic terms for some airlines. I don't think, you know, there's a bit of a false situation at the moment where, in terms of the short term, the capacity situation is more constrained than it otherwise would be. And that's helping things along a little bit.
You mentioned European airlines, and you were out and about in Brussels this week, and we'll get a flavour for what the European airline view on the world is after the break.
Hello listeners, I'm Andy Mason, and I want to introduce you to Beyond Entertainment, a new podcast from Panasonic Avionics. Each week, we sit down with the best and brightest in our industry for a quick chat on the future of passenger experience. Everything from display and audio technology to in-flight Wi-Fi and killer digital content to meaningful market research. We're looking at what's now, what's new, and what's next. So join us as we explore the passenger experience. Go Beyond Entertainment. Available now on your favorite podcasting platforms or on our website, panasonic.aero/beyondentertainment.
So welcome back. As I was saying before the break, Lewis, you've just been in Brussels for a major conference, the Airlines for Europe annual conference press meeting. And this is really the chance for Europe's biggest airlines. It's an association that covers all the players. One of the rare times you'll see all the airline CEOs take a sort of a common line on things. And I guess, you know, one of the theories or the mantras of this organisation was to less focus on what they don't have in common, which they have quite a lot not in common. But this is really aimed at focusing where they have joint requirements, where they can make progress as a whole, you're really looking at Europe at a continent level almost. And Lewis, I think certainly the noises we were getting coming out of that event was that the chief executives do see some signs of progress, although it's not straightforward, is it?
Yeah, it is. As you say, it's no coincidence this happens in the shadow of the European Parliament, this event. So, yeah, as you say, it's very much a policy and regulatory focused thing where they have agreement. And I think, I think there's a few times where the CEOs caught themselves and realised that they also want to sell a bit of a positive message here, because there is, by its very nature, the organisation is about campaigning for change and lobbying for change on issues like airspace reform, like sustainability, sustainable aviation fuel, etc. Topics where, as you say, they can agree. But equally, they were quite keen, and that came from both ends of the kind of airline spectrum, from the network carriers and the low cost, to say that there's a sense that they feel attitude towards the airline sector have changed compared to where they were pre-COVID. I think they kind of suggest that because of COVID and things that have happened since, whether it's the war in Ukraine, for example, and the impact so many things have had on air connectivity, and sort of seeing real world examples of what that means, socially and economically, broadly, I think Carsten Spohr and Michael O'Leary both said that there really has been a change in the way policymakers are viewing the airline sector, whereas I think going into COVID, the whole sustainability issue was just really ramping up. And I think they felt like they were, punching bags a bit for the sustainability cause, and that there was pretty negative, the noises they were getting from policymakers and lawmakers in Europe. There's a new commission due to start soon. And I think the broad message was, these guys understand us, understand why we're important. We like that, and we feel that's a real change. Of course, the A4E exists for a very specific reason or list of reasons, and I think at that point, obviously they revert back to pointing out where these policymakers still need to do quite a lot to help the industry.
Yeah, and it's fair to say that they are sort of tackling quite hard to make happen topics. So, single European sky is something that has been floated and talked about for years and years and years. The challenge in breaking the political deadlock, in making that happen, everyone knows about. You are unlikely to see an immediate change on that. I think probably from the airline's perspective, it is about just beating the drum for how much, you can have some sympathy for airlines on the one hand, who are largely held responsible for all stoppages and cancellations and delays in one form or another. There'll be some of those which you can lay at the door of individual airlines potentially, but there's an awful lot of those which aren't at their hands, and they are sort of blamed for pretty much every disruption. So, I think you just continue in this battle to beat a drum over about it, make people aware of the noise, the impact of it. You see, in policy terms, I think actually, even A4E probably realise an immediate leap to the single European sky is not going to happen in the short term. And you see this particular campaigning around trying to get overflights. At the moment, various rules happen when you have a strike in France. If the French air traffic controllers strike, it doesn't just impact French operated flights. It operates anything that has any kind of overflight or connection to it. And, that's where they're trying to make those wins. Do they think their arguments are being heard?
Yeah, it's a good question, because the definition of insanity question comes to mind when you talk about you just keep asking for something and you keep getting the same answer. And I think we know that there is an update to Single European Sky in progress, but there's very much a sense that is baby steps. And that those were the words used by a representative for the Commission. I think the Commission representative actually acknowledged that this wasn't what they wanted either. They want action, but the problem is there are national governments that particularly worried about security of their airspace. And, that's not a new thing. We know that's been, I think, the issue essentially all along, is that some countries do not want to lose control of their airspace. So yeah, there was an acknowledgement from the Commission. And in terms of being heard, I mean, Johan Lundgren, the EasyJet CEO, fielded that question and basically said, well, the sustainability argument has brought that kind of need for change to the fore again. In the past, you know, it was going nowhere, essentially. But now this figure gets thrown around that single European sky would lead to 10% efficiency gains, it's a fairly compelling argument, but you know, maybe not if you put it in the context of it probably being unachievable. But yeah, he does feel that it's worth pushing on with, and I think A4E do as well. But I think, as you say, that within the airspace challenge, though, it's not just about, you know, the ultimate goal there of kind of a single European sky. There are, you know, bits and pieces, improvements can be made at a lower level, perhaps not as ambitious, but certainly around the overflights issue you mentioned. Notice on strikes occurring, so I'm getting some consistency there, because I think there are some differences between different countries, so that, you know, airlines, again, when you talk about airlines getting the blame for a lot of these issues, it's very true. They are the customer-facing bit of the industry, and you know, if they're told with 12 hours notice they're not going to be able to operate half their flights the next day because of air traffic control issues, you know, quite reasonably, though, you know, maybe pushing back a bit and saying we need a bit more notice so we can actually let our customers know in good time and you know, adapt our operations accordingly.
If single European sky has been a long term issue, a short one which has cropped up far more recently is the overflights issue around Russia. It's obviously an impact following on from the outbreak of the conflict and the war in Ukraine. And I guess the chief concern for European airlines in particular, but not just actually European airlines, there's some other operators it applies to, is that not everyone is blocked from overflying Russia, are they?
No, and this is, so Chinese airlines, obviously, given their size and everything, but the ones that are cited the most in this. I think there are other Asian countries where they don't have access to, and depending on their relationship with Russia, I guess, at a diplomatic level. But obviously China, the obvious example that does. And I think this was an issue where I don't think there was necessarily a single A4E line on this, I think, but broadly, I think that the managing director of A4E and several of the CEOs, you know, whether explicitly or not, basically said they think that Chinese airlines should be blocked from landing at European airports if they've flown over Russia. You know, it's so hard because they've just been complaining, of course, that they're burning lots of extra fuel and it's having a bad impact on their sustainability because they're having to fly around Russian airspace and add 2 or 3 hours to flights. In the same breath, they're obviously suggesting that the airlines that don't have to do that should be blocked from doing it and have to copy them. So you know, that there are some tough kind of arguable contradictions to navigate through on this. But I think that not unreasonably they kind of frame that issue with Chinese airlines within a broader sense that they want a level playing field as European airlines. You know, we all know that I think in every jurisdiction there are reasons, you know, probably valid reasons that airlines have a particular issue or complaint with how they are regulated and the taxes, etc., that they face. I think the European sector in particular is quite sensitive to this at the moment. And that is largely around the whole sustainability challenge. So I think when they see, you know, Chinese airlines being able to, you know, shave time off their flights, save money on fuel and get people into Europe much more quickly, then, you know, it's not so much that's the be all and end all. It kind of just plays into this sense that while they do have a feeling that policymakers are listening to them more, that when it comes to SAF mandates, for example, where, you know, as it stands, they probably not many other places in the world where they're being mandated to use 6% of their fuel use to be SAF by 2030. They face, you know, taxation a level that perhaps isn't seen elsewhere. I mean, okay, airlines in Latin America, for example, might have something to say about that. But yeah, there's just a broad sense that, particularly on the sustainability side of things, that there's a concern that you have rules that the European Union is obviously a large bloc, and it will enforce rules that potentially could disadvantage the, particularly obviously the carriers flying out of Europe, who are going up against those Chinese carriers and obviously the big US airlines in particular.
And I think environment, obviously, and sustainability, huge topic within Europe, and arguably there's no harder continent to be flying in terms of meeting those requirements. And it's always been a tough balancing act for airlines to promote what they are doing to tackle environmental challenges against the continuing impact that, by definition, you know, air travel continues to have until net zero is reached. And we saw that came to a head actually whilst you were in Brussels, isn't it, for Air France KLM, and you know, the accusations of greenwashing.
Yeah, so Ben Smith was there, the Air France KLM CEO, and unfortunately for him, he had the situation where I think a journalist asking a question told him while he was on stage ready to answer a question that KLM had just lost its that lawsuit in an Amsterdam court where they were accused of greenwashing with their Fly Responsibly campaign. And yeah, it does, because from someone, you know, us covering the industry from where we do, it's probably, if you ask someone to name the airlines that are probably furthest ahead, certainly in what they're saying they're doing, and kind of, it's not unreasonable to say, you know, making a point of publicly talking about the challenges the sector faces in its decarbonisation push, then KLM comes to mind. But the courts essentially ruled that it gave a misleading impression of flying with KLM, essentially, of the reduction in environmental impact that it would have. And it's a cautionary tale, really, for airlines. I think there's a sense maybe that broad brush claims about being environmentally friendly maybe are things to be very cautious about, particularly at this stage of the industry's journey. I think being more specific about what you're doing is probably safer. I think the lesson may be to just be careful with the wording around how you're broadly talking about the industry. I mean, Ben Smith, you know, pushed back, I think, a bit on the ruling, suggesting that, you know, in terms of concrete action that the airline is taking, it's obviously its biggest investment is in fleet, which is bringing, you know, not insignificant efficiency gains for KLM's aircraft. So in that sense, you know, he felt it was unfair, the ruling. You know, and I think ultimately that ruling isn't, I don't think, will have a material impact beyond the, you know, an arguable dent to reputation slightly for KLM and perhaps for the wider industry in that one particular instance. And I think, you know, the whole industry is feeling its way really still on a sustainability. We know that a lot's happened over that since COVID. It's really shot up the agenda. But we're also in the early stages of you know, even obviously buying new aircraft was happening before this, but really the things that are going to make a difference, including SAF, which really is the one that everyone talks about making the biggest difference by 2050, is still in very early stages of development. So, and that is one of the key messages from A4E on to policymakers, is we very quickly need to develop a SAF industry in Europe so that we can meet our 6% mandates. Otherwise, we're just going to be paying orders of magnitude more than jet fuel for the little bit of SAF that's available leading up to every target. So yeah, I think it's a cautionary tale, and as I say, probably one that was inevitable for an industry that's not done this before, I guess, is the key point. But yeah, that kind of a side note on a much stronger message on, you know, please build a SAF industry. It can't be that hard, can it?
Well, we will see. We will see. That's certainly the hope and optimism, and that's definitely the primary message, not just within Europe. I think as we go about our various press conferences, events, everywhere you go, that is pretty much the fundamental message that airlines and the wider aerospace sector are asking for and pleading for. It's taking some time to get there, but we should probably leave it there on that big issue. Lewis, thank you for your time again.
Thank you, Graham.
Our thanks again to Panasonic Avionics for sponsoring the podcast. Do give the Beyond Entertainment podcast a listen. A reminder, you can catch up on all the news and stories you mentioned in this podcast at flightglobal.com. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please like and review us. Don't forget to subscribe to get new episodes in your podcast feeds directly. And we'll see you again next time.